Now, this week I've got a very special guest, the author Patrick Mackey, taking a look at his book Mozart in Motion, his work and his world in pieces. Now, this is a very apt title for the book. Having given it a good read myself, it takes a look at the psychology of Mozart, his approach to composition, his approach to performing, but also within the context of what was swirling around him in motion, literally politics, society, the Age of Enlightenment, the influences of his family, his father Leopold, his mother, his wife Constanza, and all of this with each chapter also kind of being rooted in an actual piece of Mozart's itself. So it's actually very, very interesting. Now, before we jump to that, I would ask that you give me a rating on whichever podcast platform that you use. It really helps for people to find this little podcast of mine. And now to my chat with Patrick. Patrick, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on your show.
So, Mozart in Motion. I'm going to start with a really obvious question because your background to date has been mainly publishing poetry.
Yeah.
And you chose Mozart as your first subject to dive into. So why Mozart? Right.
In a way, it began with the fact that with poetry, you know, nobody much cares what you write about, so you get to write about whatever you want. In the proper established commercial publishing business, it feels like all these decisions are so overdetermined. So I thought I'd maybe just take some of the license of the poetry world and see how that worked if I applied it to trying to write a more commercial book. And just thought that since no one was asking me to do it, I'd better do it on something that I really, really like and see what happens. And then at least if everyone ends up saying, well, you know, we never asked you to write it in the first place, so excuse us, but we're not that interested. That wouldn't at least seem too much of a waste of time to me. So I picked something that I knew that I wanted that I could easily stand spending years, you know, even though they turned out to be fairly pointless years otherwise, listening to and thinking about and caring about. And just thought it was worth sort of taking that gamble and doing things slightly differently that way. So it had to be something that would really nourish me in itself. And I guess the second answer to that question, that in a way you as with all of these enterprises, you sort of discover the answers to them as you go along. So it's slightly a matter of making it up backwards in these respects anyway. And the other justification, I suppose, that became clearer and clearer, and I guess may have been a sort of instinct in the first place, was that it would sort of allow me to write about everything else too. Because Mozart was so plugged into so many things, led such a, you know, voracious, various life at such a pivotal, interesting, you know, complex moment in European and world history, it meant that his music actually didn't just stay where it was. That's, I guess, part of the point of the title. It moves in every direction and hence could take, you know, a project and take my thinking in all these different directions too. So it was partly that I really wanted to write about Mozart, and it was partly that actually I discovered that everything else was there too, and I didn't really have to have made the decision in the first place.
Well, you know, I think you're onto a good thing because you can't go wrong with Mozart.
Yeah, right? That's right.
You know, lots going on there.
Yeah.
So Mozart in Motion, that is the title of the book. And I believe your first chapter is Mozart in Motion, Don Giovanni. In Motion, Don Giovanni. So
exactly.
Maybe delve into that whole motion aspect to it.
Yeah. So I mean, funny enough, the beginning of the book really came to me as a proper beginning. So I think a lot of times with books, that doesn't necessarily happen, and they get sort of constructed after the fact. But this one really threw me into the action of thinking about the book. It ended up being quite a chronological book otherwise, and ends up in some ways being quite a conventional biography in some of its ordering and storytelling and so on. But I always wanted it to start there, and I always felt that it started there at the premiere of Don Giovanni in Prague in the autumn of 1787, because I really wanted to throw people into the mix of Mozart's music at its most intense, at a sort of zenith of his career, but also at its most, you know, world saturated, at its, you know, with all of the paraphernalia and the excitement and the anxiety and the myriads of factors that go into an opera first night. So I felt like because I ended up wanting to major on this aspect of the music that led out into the world and led Mozart into the world and kept on pulling the world into the music, an opera first night was the sort of perfect epitome for that.
Mm-hmm.
And because Don Giovanni is such a incredibly contradictory and complex opera, and the period I was writing the book, you know, they've always been there, of course, all these factors, but it was also the period of Me Too and all sorts of different sorts of debates regarding a lot of the questions that you're raising by writing an opera about someone who can, you know, euphemistically in some respects be termed a great seducer, but plenty of other things you could be called too. So there was a sense of an object that wasn't staying still as I listened to it, that was part of what I wanted to get at by going with motion as the subject of the book. And of course, it's an opera that, you know, travels across Europe as Don Giovanni himself does. I mean, it's set in just one place in terms of the actual action, but it draws on this whole mythological past of this guy who's been, you know, engaging in his often dubious conquests across the continent. So it sort of opens up all these areas of travel, and I guess in a way that's very exciting in one way, because the story is an exciting one, but in ways that are very troubling and, you know, raise all sorts of inquiries too.
Mm-hmm. And I picked up on one quote, which I really loved. You said, at the core of Mozart's work is the attempt to reckon with the coming of the modern world.
Right.
And I also assume interweaved within that, of course, you do talk a lot about his interactions with the Enlightenment, which is also happening. Yeah. So maybe delve into that a little bit, because again, I think that speaks to the motion as well, societally.
Mm. That's right, and it literally does, in the sense that it obviously for me it's all rooted in a way in the many, many different roots in both senses, roots in the ground and also roots across the ground, that his childhood raised, and that this bizarre childhood as a, you know, as this sort of traveling genius being hawked across Europe. As something in between a sort of prince of consciousness and a delightful little bauble for the rich to gaze at and marvel at. And what I think that gave to Mozart was an extraordinary sort of double consciousness that I really wanted to trace out, and that I think placed him right at the heart of what was going on in Europe generally at the time, where he knew the old world of the courts, of sort of princely Europe, of the old hierarchies and forms of status and wealth and power and so on, absolutely inside out. You know, he had the knowledge of them that you only get by trying to please them as ardently as he and his father had spent his childhood trying to get him to do. But he also, I think, had an extraordinary feel for their weaknesses and for the elements of them that were pushing in different directions. The sense in which that society was beginning to be, you know, on the move in literal ways and taking itself across the world and drawing more of the world into its schemes, but also on the move into intellectual terms, in aesthetic terms, in terms of this extraordinary sort of productivity. We're talking about the very early years, I guess, of the Industrial Revolution, but revolutions in taste and ideas of politics and, you know, the practical life of cities as well. And I had a sense of his music being pulled in all these different directions and knowing that it wanted to please all these different people all at once. You know, his consciousness was a sort of pleasure machine and had been turned into one at a very early age by the intensity with which he could give pleasure and by the intensity for good and ill with which his father in particular, you know, decided to exploit that fact. But he just lived at a time when, as it happens, Europe's pleasures were intensely on the move and pulling it in all these different directions. So pleasure became a sort of source of insight and of constructive analysis, I think, in his music of all the different factors that make up such a complex society.
And that's certainly also what drew me into the book, is the fact that it's quite complex in terms of this wonderful picture that you delve into what's happening within society, what's happening with him personally, his psychology as things are bouncing around, and of course his output of music and how all of these different variables are constantly in a state of flux, it almost seems.
Yeah, exactly. That was what made it so intensely sort of delightful in a way to keep writing about him, was that the more I threw at his music, so to speak, in terms of what I thought it was about, the more the music kept on just emerging out of that with this sort of extraordinary sort of purity of radiance and beauty on the other side of all that complexity too. So there are always these two different things going on. And I felt like that was, you know, in my sort of account of things anyway, I felt like that was how day-to-day life must have felt for him all the time. Mm. That, and I think his letters bear that out in our sense of the sort of chaos that his personal and financial life were often in, bear that out too. That he was balancing so many factors, trying to please so many people, trying to pay the bills, trying to appeal to new sorts of audiences, trying to keep directors of operas on side, trying to make sure that he wasn't falling foul of the changes of taste and changes of censorship regimes and so on. And yet the more that there is in the music, the more that all these factors are there, it's as if that is what forces it to be so intensely pleasing. It has to sort of come out of all of that with this extraordinary sort of aesthetic impact that both carries that momentum with it and leaves it all behind and just says, here's something stunning for you to listen to. And I love that sort of double motion that happens, I think, in listening to Mozart, where you get everything that the world is about and you get this other thing that's going on that's just the sheer precision and radiance of aesthetic impact at its most heightened. And each chapter in the book, that's one of the reasons why I decided what each chapter in the book should really major on some particular work, and sometimes indeed zoom in on a real detail in some particular one of his works. You know, sometimes it's a whole opera, but sometimes it's a, you know, a particular phrase or a particular movement, and really show how, you know, the sort of sensual details of what we all get out of this stuff are linked to the world and how they also keep on leaving it behind and doing their own thing.
And I was going to mention that what I also loved is the fact that you with each chapter you state a piece of music. And it's funny because as I was reading the book, I was also going to YouTube and quickly, yeah, refreshing my memory.
Yeah,
on,
exactly.
On different pieces.
I get that a lot from readers, and it's really wonderful to hear.
I think, but it's so wonderfully, it's wonderful because then you've got this music happening in your head, yeah, in the background, yeah, as you're reading the text.
Yeah.
How did you, I mean, he wrote an awful lot. So how did you manage to narrow down on the pieces that you did, other than maybe the obvious ones like Don Giovanni and Così fan tutti, etc.?
Yeah, it's such a good question, but I honestly, it's it's such a good question that I don't know the answer. I mean, exactly. There were some that sort of had to be there one way or the other, in terms of, yeah, just their importance. But there are amazing works that I don't write on. You know, some of my favorite works, some of the piano concertos that I don't write on, the great K361 serenade that's, you know, featured famously in the film Amadeus, I don't write on. These are works that mean as much to me as anything. So in a way, it was the works that just, that I suppose it goes back to that sort of double movement I was speaking about a minute ago. It was the works where I just, they were so full of intellectual content, and yet that intellectual content and that sense of sort of storytelling and the amount you had to say about them were absolutely summed up in some incredibly precise, radiant, sensual detail that sort of wouldn't leave me alone. So for Così fan tutti, for instance, I just became sort of incredibly hooked on the particular way in which the sisters at the beginning of the opera sing the word amore in Italian. And you know, I had no sense that this was the detail that I should be writing about. You know, when I sat down to write about that opera, that was the detail that kept on going through my head. So it was sort of, I was sort of hypnotized into, the music hypnotized me into deciding how to structure each chapter in a way. And because I was writing it off my own bat with no particular, you know, commission and no particular reason to be doing it apart from my sense that there was something there that wanted me to do it, I guess I just waited until something told me with sufficient, you know, sort of force and unignorability that they wanted to be written about, and then I tried to be obedient.
And would you, if you hit a sticking point in your writing, would you go back to his music and have a listen?
Yeah. I mean, in a way that, strangely, I mean, I really thought that would happen a lot more with the music. And everyone, when I said I was going to write a book about music, everyone said, oh, it's so hard to write. You know, strangely, and I don't know whether this, you know, this might have turned out to be a very, very bad sign, and it may yet for some readers. I hope that, you know, the book is going well enough with enough people that I can think it's a good sign. That actually, funny enough, I didn't really find that with the music. I found that if I just really responded to it and assumed that it was that it was about the things that our lives are all about, then it really told me what it was about. The thing that I found myself much more stuck on, that I found it harder to write about, was really getting to grips with, you know, the ways in which 18th century life can feel incredibly similar to ours and incredibly different. Mm. And sometimes you can get hooked up on one aspect of that and think, oh, it's simple, it's just like now, they're all modern and so on and so on. And then sometimes you can get hooked on, oh, they're so archaic with their funny costumes. And I was trying to avoid either of those extremes. And I found that much more difficult. Mm. But that wasn't what you asked about.
That's okay. even, you know, interviewing about this, it's monolithic. Right. Let's get into family. So you do, first of all, his mother, you do talk about his mother. I'm interested to know from your perspective, because he sort of, I think, dragged her along for a bit on his travels. But when she passed away, did this or did this not affect his music at the time?
It's such a good question. It's so hard to know. It's one of the most mysterious episodes in Mozart's whole mysterious life. And in some ways, I think of it as the key episode because of the strangeness with which it seems to have struck him. What happened was he'd set off, in a way, the last of his useful travels, which was also, in a way, his first, you know, broaching of his own status as a sort of great composer in the making, claiming to be, you know, an autonomous figure, ready for the world, ready to take it on its own terms, which had meant that his father had finally let him go without him. But the caveat being that he had to take along his mother instead. And I guess the idea for Mozart was that this was the beginning of a new period of autonomy. The idea for his father was that he would still have the mother there to keep an eye on him and to report back. And it was a very difficult journey altogether. Mozart found it very complicated. I think a lot of the book is about this, the sort of transition from being a sort of child star to being an autonomous artist in his own right was a very, very difficult and complicated one. Where his great achievement in a way, with you can phrase it as the triumph of genius over genius, if you like, triumph of one sort of genius over the sort that he'd already been. And the death of his mother in Paris was an extraordinarily important part of that. But I think it's important precisely because it's so mysterious what really happened. She found the journey difficult and became ill, as people often did in the big cities in those days, where standards of hygiene were extremely complex and attenuated, and standards of medicine in particular were bizarre, to say the least, and she was a real victim of that. And it's extremely unclear what Mozart made of it. His letters at the time, I suppose it shows the complexity of his psyche in general and becomes a sort of epitome of it. His letters back to his father are intensely moving in their sense of what the loss meant to him, extremely careful and rather thoughtful and quite odd and strategic in terms of how he told the story to his father. And then at the same time, they can depart into the sort of exuberant and merry recounting of his not terribly impressive or lasting successes in the Paris music scene. And it's a very strange thing to get to grips with. It's a very strange psychic moment to try to understand. So I write quite a bit about a particular piano sonata that he wrote around then, the K310 keyboard sonata, which I think epitomizes the extraordinary strain that his psyche was under at the time. But it also, I think, epitomizes how hard it is to read exactly what his response to that strain was, and how, in a way, the creation of all this beauty, all this these revolutionary, extraordinarily cogent forms, was an escape from the complexity of his life in some ways, in some ways it can feel as though it's expressing it, but in some ways it always goes beyond it and makes it very hard to say exactly what the story really was.
Mm. And speaking of strain, there was his father.
Yes, the back of all of the strain.
Right. Now, what I found interesting was you do speak to and allude to the fact that Mozart in his various travels almost searches for other father figures.
Right. Yeah.
Which I thought psychologically was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, that's what I mean. Most of the writers, that there was a tendency, I think, certainly when I was reading up about him, to feel as though writers really find it hard to resist going into camps as far as Leopold is concerned. Either, you know, wasn't it terrible? What a cruel man, this sort of despot dragging this poor child across Europe to try to squeeze cash out of him. All the ones who give him so much credit for producing Mozart in the first place and for forcing him to being, that they form a sort of pro-Leopold faction. And I found myself really sort of oscillating in the middle. And what I ended up thinking was that, well, the great thing about Leopold Mozart was that he gave Wolfgang, his son, enough of a problem that he had to become, you know, the sort of complex composer and the complex psyche that he was. And I guess part of the argument of the book is that that happened, that one of the reasons why Mozart happens, so to speak, as a composer, as a cultural phenomenon, is that his particular psyche at that time and his relationship to Leopold just happened to coincide with a period of extraordinary openness with regard to inheritance and filiation and how you take on the legacies of older generations in European culture generally and in music in particular. So the sort of third quarter, if you like, of the 18th century, the period that leads up to Mozart's emergence, is weirdly a period where there's no major European composer sort of reigning over the whole of the musical scene. It's very anomalous in that regard. There's, you know, Haydn is on his way and he's already producing masterpiece after masterpiece as it happens, but he's sort of hidden away in the Hungarian countryside at the Esterházy court. The great generation of Scarlatti and Bach and Handel has passed away around the middle of the century. And Gluck is probably the most sort of manful, his is probably the most manful attempt to provide a sort of all-over account of what music is capable of at the time. But actually, it's a period of intensely many sort of brilliant minor composers and brilliant minor achievements. And I think Mozart comes out of that, and he's the one who can actually inherit the entire culture of the century because, you know, in the phrase I use in the book, he turns out to be what you might call a genius at being a son, a genius at knowing how to find fathers and how to transform their legacies, how to make them his own. And I think his astonishing capacity to be both amazingly syncretic and to synthesize ingredients from every direction, while at the same time being unmistakably himself, incredibly autonomous and forward-thinking and sort of willful in his sense of artistic purpose, that was what having such an extraordinarily strong, dominant, complex figure as a father has taught him, had made necessary for him, and therefore made possible for his music.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk also about Mozart, composer versus performer, because I did pick up on, you know, obviously he spends a lot of time in Vienna and this notion of praise.
Right.
Yeah, talk to me about that. I find that
fascinating. Well, I just got interested. I suppose I was I just got interested in what it was like for someone to have been praised so highly by such intense. It felt like a topic that I hadn't actually seen covered in the myriad books about Mozart. Just directly what it feels like to be praised and to be congratulated and applauded and so on. It must have been such an extraordinary part of his life from such an early age, and for it to be coming, you know, in any setting, in the sort of dimmest little parlor in provincial England, it can be an extraordinarily narcotic phenomenon, as we know, praise. But when it's coming from, you know, the crown heads of Europe and the most glamorous, you know, well-dressed, gleaming ladies and gentlemen of the courts, and, you know, and also from the great composers and intellectual figures of the day, it must have been a very, very peculiar thing to cope with. And I, as I say, rather like what I was saying with the sort of overcoming of genius earlier, it feels as though he had to have a very, very rich account, give himself a very, very rich account of what it meant to be praised in that way, to treat it as, you know, to find it as nourishment and fuel for further achievement, to feel that each time he had to go and sort of earn it all over again, often by producing work that was actually quite difficult for people to accept later on in his career and difficult for people to praise in the same terms. And I found that really phenomenal. And I guess I what I try and do in the book is try to draw out, you know, how that works within the textures of performance, and therefore what it would have felt like for him to be a performer of the keyboard in particular, where he was such a noted virtuoso. And then how that particular sort of doubleness plays out in composition, and how composing itself, you know, the relationship between, amongst the many different things that are sort of in flux in the period that I think Mozart takes to heart, the relationship precisely between performance and composition are changing. And it's, you know, it's just becoming possible to sort of think of yourself as someone who might make a living just as a composer, sending work. It doesn't quite happen within Mozart's lifetime, but it's sort of on the way as a new type of artistic figure, a new type of commercial figure. But at the time, everything had to be very located still in performance and often improvisation and in teaching as well. And I feel my argument is that within the work, you can often feel a sort of dialogue in particular works between the sort of explosive desire for flair and impact within the room that you're performing for, and a desire for a more sort of careful, structured, artistic entity that will sort of endure beyond each occasion and allow itself to be reinvented on new terms elsewhere, and so on. And again, this is also a dialogue that I think is going on in his work that his, you know, particular strange past and complex present opened up for him.
And let's also finish off the family trio, maybe in simplistic terms, Constanza. Yes. One thing, when you were talking about Cosi fan tutti, I picked up this wonderful metaphor that you used, quote, his it sort of represented his own failures and transformations in the erotic sphere.
Right.
So yeah, what did you mean by that?
Well, so he has this, I mean, it's around the same, it's why that trip with his mother is one of the many reasons why it's so sort of fraught and complicated and fateful, is that it coincides, it brings about, in fact, his first major love affair, which is his failed courtship of a young singer that he met in Mannheim during their journeys, who ends up rejecting him, is his sort of glamorous ideal woman. She, you know, they're going to sort of take Europe by storm together in the fantasies that he sets out. His father, back in Salzburg, is absolutely horrified, and eventually everyone's relief, apart from Wolfgang himself, and probably nobody's surprise apart from Wolfgang himself, she dumped him rather unceremoniously while he was on his way back from this awful trip to Paris back to Salzburg. The twist being that when he then moves to Vienna in the early 1780s, he reconnects with the family that she was from and ends up courting instead, and in the end marrying and making a life with her younger sister, Constanza, mm-hmm. who's a much less glamorous, she's also a singer, but she's less talented, she's less glamorous, but she turns out to be, I think, an incredibly interesting and sort of complex figure in her own right. And you know, I mean, I ended up very pro-Constanza in my, so other accounts aren't quite so much, but I ended up thinking that she was definitely the right woman for him to have married. And ended up, I think, really looking after his estate very carefully and cleverly too, after his death too.
In right, right.
And yeah. Cosi fan tutti is an opera then that I think once I really sort of got to grips with the strangeness of this turn and the way that it's an example of, you know, turning disaster into triumph, which is also what all opera plots are sort of wanting to do anyway, turning the rejection by one sister into a successful marriage with the other. It then became incredibly interesting to me that Cosi fan tutti is an opera precisely about the, you know, in ways that are deliciously interesting and exuberant in some ways and rather troubling and bizarre in others, you know, the erotic interchangeability of two sisters and indeed of their two suitors, the two men, owing to, you know, a classic 18th century fast plot full of sort of imbroglios and disguises and mistaken identities and so on. You end up actually not knowing, it's a sort of famous crux for all productions of the opera, how the couples actually end up. We know that they end up all living happily ever after, but it's slightly unclear from the libretto who does end up with who. The couples go back to their original shape or actually stick with the new couplings that are formed as a result of the strange plot that's unleashed by the men on the women. So yeah, it just seemed to be incredibly interesting that he had somehow come up with, you know, however that plot eventuated is very unclear, which is an interesting fact in itself, because mostly at the time opera plots were extremely conventional and repetitive and drawn from the same sources. But this seems to have been an original plot somewhere in Vienna in the 1780s, whoever originated it. Some rumors at the time said it was Joseph, the emperor himself. It may have been de Ponte, Mozart's great librettist, or it may have come partly from Mozart. In any case, one way or the other, he ended up with a plot that somehow sort of replicates and itself transforms this story of transformation that his own erotic life had needed and enacted. So yeah, I think that sort of, for me, that ended up explaining why this opera that's such an extraordinary contraption in some ways, that has the most amazing perfection as an act of dramatic musical machinery, also does feel so intensely moving and so personal. It's quite a peculiar combination. That something that sort of whirs along and is so contrived and so sort of perfect as an artifact also does feel incredibly touching and as though it, you know, comes from the heart somewhere. And so my argument in the end is that that's why.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk a lot throughout the book about his humor. And I thought this was very interesting because, again, in typical portrayals of Mozart, you know, he's very irreverent. But then, you know, you've got this coexistence of sacred, secular, and secular music that he's outputting. How does all of this balance?
Yeah. So I love that question, and I love thinking about that through the book because I was trying to, I was constantly in danger of getting overexcited myself by how erotic, let's put it that way. And I thought, oh, isn't it wonderful? He's taking the mickey out of everything. He's saying, right. Yet that obviously wasn't the whole story.
Right.
In all sorts of good ways, in terms of the, you know, transcendent power and the feel for seriousness of purpose and so on, and a moral consequence in his music and in his operas, but also in some ways he was a very conventional man, and he seems to have been quite a devout Catholic, and he was in some ways a very obedient courtier at different stages of his life as well.
Right.
And so I ended up trying to put it all together in a slightly more complex way, and saying that that the point of comedy and humor, in a way, particularly when it's nearly addictive and obsessional, as it seems to have been for Mozart, is to learn from it what seriousness should be. That in a way it's by trying to be funny all the time, you figure out the things that you should take seriously, because right. They're the ones that stay standing. They're the ones that no matter how much you mock them, they keep on going and you return to them. And I feel like his music sort of does that for itself, and his sensibility did that to the world constantly, sort of threw jokes at it at such a pace and with such sort of ribaldry that he figured out, actually, I think more deeply than anyone at the time, you know, what it was that was solemn and serious about the moral world that was coming into being.
Yeah. Because that, yeah, as I say, the typical portrayal is him as the court jester.
Right.
But, you know, you touched on another thing, which I also thought was very fascinating, is the fact that he was part of the Viennese Freemasonry.
Yeah.
His father was as well. He joined in 1784. So again, this is not, I kind of did a double take because this just doesn't seem like the Mozart that
the
people talk about.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Funny enough, I was at a talk recently, a big academic talk in Oxford by a guy over here in England, by a guy, who was talking about actually international diplomacy and its place in Mozart. And during the questions and answers, somebody said, okay, that's very interesting. Now, what I'd like to know is how all this connects to the Freemasons. And the speaker said, well, that's very interesting too, but I'm afraid I don't want to get involved in all of that question. There are enough books written about it, and I'm not going to answer that at all. And there's a side of me that sympathizes with that. Like, it's such a complex issue, and people have such, you know, understandably complex and overdetermined feelings about the Freemasons, that I really almost wanted to ignore it altogether. But actually, I found it really interesting, in a way, precisely, to connect it with the previous question, because I think the thing about Freemasonry is, in a way, we don't know quite how seriously to take it now.
Right.
We don't know quite how seriously to take it as part of 1780s culture. I think we should actually take it really seriously. But on the other hand, there was obviously an element of make it up as you go along about it. It was a sort of extravagant cultural improvisation in its own way. One of my interests, I suppose, in its role in Mozart's life was that far from, I think, providing, I think he wanted it to provide sort of authority and a vision of the world and so on. He also wanted it to provide connections and worldly help. But I think actually in the end, it was just as synthetic and strange and full of odd accretions and improvisations as he was and as his music was. and I think was a very, very various phenomenon, probably. And, you know, there are people who've gone into exactly what each lodge in Vienna was doing, but it's an incredibly complicated scene, full of factions, full of splinter groups, full of people who thought Freemasonry was a new spiritual vision designed to regenerate European humanity with a new vision of the divine, and people who thought it was, you know, a jolly way to spend a night out with some chaps, and people who thought it was a political conspiracy designed to create, you know, a new world of democratic liberty. It seems to have been a profound argument with itself about itself, Freemasonry at its best. Mm. And I guess that's the aspect of it that I ended up thinking, whether it's what appealed to Mozart about it in the first place, it's what I think must have resonated with Mozart and what I think tells us most about, you know, what the stakes were in the society and the culture at the time for him and his music.
I think I'm going to go with, it was another vehicle for Mozart to find meaning.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you say,
I could have given a much shorter answer with that.
People write, you know, these huge novels about the meaning and intricacies, but maybe it was just another thing that he was attempting to find meaning in somewhat disorder in his life. And also you mentioned, and I thought this was also very interesting, you mentioned the keyboard itself being almost like a lifeline for him. This is, I think, later in the book. Speak again, or along his psychology, but
exactly. But so again, I think it's just remarkable the degree of the sort of symbiosis that he had with the keyboard from such an early age, that it was what conferred identity on him. And yet it was an object that was designed for extravagance and transformation and expressive impact. So the very thing that was meant to tell him most deeply who he was and to confirm his place in the world was also a thing that threw him out into the world and threw him into people's chambers and people's ears and into the need to please and to perform. And so I got interested, I suppose, in the sort of double meaning that must have had for him, and what a strange role it must have played in his life as a result, and how I think you can hear that in the combined desire for intensity of expression and also for control and order and in a way sort of closed meaning that I think the keyboard sometimes has for him. I think it varies a lot over the course of his life as well, and one of the reasons why that's particularly interesting and particularly complex is that the keyboard itself is varying over the course of his life, what it was as an object. So, so this is the period when the harpsichord, which in a way he'd sort of been weaned on, gives way gradually and partly under the impact of the likes of Mozart to the fortepiano. You know, what we think of as the modern piano, but in its slightly smaller, you know, not quite the Steinway grand that we're used to now, but nevertheless with a sort of hammer mechanism and it's a very different sort of instrument altogether. And I think Mozart's music is often trying to calibrate what this meant and trying to glue these two very disparate, I mean, glue was a big factor in the making of keyboards at the times, because these things took a lot of punishment. They were carried around. They were hoiked in and out of buildings and carried along rutted streets and so on. So, you know, they also just had to literally cohere, as well as being the vehicles for making your life and your music cohere. And I think that the keyboard became this glue in itself, this thing that sort of held his life together. And that was a way of showing how culture can work to hold things together, a way of showing how what culture at its most expansive and most radiant, but also most, you know, most pragmatically helpful within our lives is for taking things that pull us in different directions and showing how they can be made compatible after all, showing how they can be held in balance with each other, often in very tense, sometimes exciting, sometimes troubling balance, but nevertheless brought to a sort of state of equilibrium. And, you know, the keyboard and his continuing, you know, he was constantly being pulled between the keyboard and the opera house as the two main vehicles for his art. And it's extraordinary, his loyalty to the keyboard in some ways, particularly in the later 1780s, when it doesn't seem to have quite had the magic that it had previously for Viennese audiences, but also the sort of disloyalty within that loyalty, the ways in which he's constantly reinventing it, constantly wanting it to become a new instrument, constantly ringing the changes on it. So there are very, very odd keyboard pieces from very, very late in his life that I think show him working really in a completely new sort of formal in a way, sort of auditory sphere from the big sonatas that we know from the mid-1780s. That's a side of his career that I don't go into as much in the book as I'd have liked to, but he sort of got interested in the world of sort of mechanical keyboards and automata and all sorts of new opportunities of that sort too.
And you sort of allude to the fact that he's when he's in Vienna, he's constantly under pressure to compose hits. But right. I interject because the chapter that had me do a double take, double time, was then you talk about Prince's hit song in the 1980s, yeah. Little Red Corvette.
Right.
And I looked at that and I went, where's he going with this?
Okay.
And that totally came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But really cool comparison with Mozart. But also you talk about, and I also found this fascinating, the post-production process of producing music in the early 1980s versus orchestral instruments. So speak to that, because that was cool.
That sort of came to me in a way through listening to that song over and over again to try and figure out why I thought it did have something to say about Mozart. I turned to Prince because of this factor of performance and excitement and really wanting to get what it might feel like to be a hit maker and to have all the excitement but also all the demands of that. But then listening to that song over and over again, I guess that the analogy started to sort of multiply. And I got interested in this extraordinary sound world of the early 1980s that I was a kid in that period. So it's there's a sort of sound of well-produced 80s pop that I'm incredibly used to and grew up with. And it feels so in that song, you can sort of feel it coming out of the world of 70s soul and disco and funk and all these very, very disparate factors that Prince is synthesizing, I think, with the talent pretty much as prodigious as Mozart's for combining elements. And making them all work in a new auditory world. And I got interested in what it must have been like for him to be so committed to being an in-the-moment performer, singer, dancer, you know, the sort of all-singing or dancing pop phenomenon that we know Prince was, and yet has such an acute sense of making an object that would last and that would sound right and that would combine so many sort of dimensions. And this meant working on it afterwards in this incredibly different sort of working environment of a studio, and how that would relate to someone like Mozart being so used to just dazzling people at the keyboard, and then having to think, well, actually, how am I going to construct something that's going to work on a different scale, that's going to be replicable with different sorts of players and different settings, that's going to speak to this new world of orchestral concerts that are going on across the continent. So it just seemed like it was an analogy worth
taking seriously. It was inspired. I think we need more of that.
Yeah.
To be able to connect the 1980s with the 18th century, I think we need more of that. So that people say, you know what? It's we're not so different in some ways. Okay, so as we sort of wrap this up, of course, I want to end up with the Requiem and his eventual downfall. Mm. Now, you do explore and touch upon the mysteriousness of the commission, his health, the fact that the piece itself, of course, was completed by others.
So maybe set
the scene for me about that.
Yeah, so that's right. So it's such a ridiculous gift to a writer about Mozart, that whole story. You know, it feels as though you just have this amazing endpoint that you're pulling towards all the time, that he should have, you know, been writing a requiem on his deathbed, and a requiem with this extraordinarily colorful and odd story behind it, which turns out to be, in fact, not so mysterious after all. It's I think people, we all, and I definitely included, sort of slightly cling to the idea that it was mysterious, when in fact it's all been pretty much set out in fairly irrefutable scholarly terms what indeed happen about the commission. And indeed, my argument is that it wouldn't have been mysterious even to Mozart at the time, who was commissioning him in the very small, gossipy, rivalrous world of Viennese music. But what it produced was this work that one way or the other is incredibly mysterious. And I think for a very different reason, which is to say, how is it so good when A, he was writing it under so much pressure, and B, a lot of it he wasn't writing at all, but just leaving often quite rudimentary instructions for his his assistants and students. Eventually, one particular uncle, Süssmayr, is one of Constanze's, I think, many inspired decisions to get Süssmayr to do it, to push on with the commission after Mozart's death and to ensure that this thing saw the light of day at all. But it's completely, it's sort of inexplicable to me why it works so well. And I ended up thinking that it's a sign of just how extraordinarily forceful this power of synthesis in his musical imagination had become by that stage, that it could sort of infect others, if you like, that he could set up an expressive template and set up the sort of terms of operation for a piece like that with such a sense of sort of momentum and rigor, but also openness and porousness to it, that it works extraordinarily well. And I think the elements of it that feel a bit clumsy in some of the writing later on in the piece, in the bits that he didn't fully write out himself, and the inevitable sort of klutziness of some of the repetitions when music is reused from earlier movements for bits where it wouldn't necessarily be used later on. Actually, they just end up producing an even more moving work to me. They end up producing a work that sort of speaks of mortality and loss and fragmentariness in a language that's itself made of mortality and loss and fragmentariness. But that also has this extraordinary sort of will to completion and capacity for radiance built in. So yeah, it's one of the strangest pieces, I think, to carry on. I mean, every time I listen to it, people are always doing different versions of it as well. So it becomes a sort of endless quest. There's an extraordinarily good recent recording of it by the great Catalan early music pioneer, Jordi Savall. When I finished writing this book, one of the things that I was, I suppose, afraid of was that I wouldn't, you know, just be able to carry on having the excuse of listening to Mozart music for the rest of my life. But luckily, people are producing such extraordinary examples of these performances that I feel the excuse is sort of always there. And the Requiem in particular is so open to reinterpretation. It so needs reinterpretation. And I've ended up thinking of that as, you know, as its great strength rather than a lack.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. And I think that, you know, for listeners who are thinking of picking up the book, I will put, of course, a link in the show notes right, for how you can order one of the books. But I mean, I tried through this interview to kind of pinpoint certain areas of the book. But I mean, quite frankly, we could keep talking for another 2 hours, because I think, as we talked about, it's, you know, it just, it addresses what's happening politically and societally, and psychologically. There's just so much there, as well as just the pieces themselves and feeling inspired to listen to those again. And I think, it's wonderful the way that you approached that.
Oh, I'm so great. Well, that's really wonderful to hear. And as I say, I mean, while you're saying all of that, I was also just hearing it as a description of Mozart's music, that it's doing all that. And sort of that's the point. So that's incredibly gratifying.
So now that you've covered off Mozart, what's next? Schoenberg?
I do love Schoenberg. I do love Schoenberg. It's not impossible, but
go for something a little different.
Yeah, strangely, one of the weird thing that's happened that I never saw coming, it'll sound like the weirdest thing to say that I didn't see it coming, was that I suddenly got really into Beethoven symphonies.
Wonderful.
I mean, I've always loved them, of course, but I've loved them as much as you're meant to love them, if you know what I mean. And no
very
more.
Interesting.
I never thought they were particularly for me as sort of real things to get to grips with. But something about, I think, hearing them as maybe through the prism of Mozart. And come out of Mozart, being saturated in Mozart. They've suddenly started to really come to me with incredible sort of freshness. So I might try and
I love that. You know, it's ironic that right now I'm doing, and this is me geeking out, but I've been doing a lot of harmonic analysis between Mozart and Beethoven. That's and those are the two that I focused on, because I'm like, okay, so how did these dudes differ in terms of, you know, their keys and how they fiddle around with things and take snippets.
Tell me, I need to know. This is.
Yeah, well,
I haven't
finished yet, but that's me geeking out. But I just
do you write up that stuff? I mean, do you write? Do you have? Do you have a
I do. I usually, I print out the music and literally work through it. Okay, we start with one chord and then we're going to go to this key and that key. And of course, with Beethoven, I mean, I really wanted to look at how he takes just a simple unit or theme or sub-theme and then makes an entire piece out of it. I mean, it's absolute brilliance. Yeah. But anyway, that's for our next conversation when you finish the book on Beethoven. And you're in the UK, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Whereabouts are you located?
So, do you know the UK bit? It's rural Gloucestershire, which is sort of, tiny island that nowhere is far from anywhere, but it's about sort of an hour and a half, 2 hours west of London.
Very nice.
The beginning of the rural west.
I actually grew up in England. My accent has faded a lot. I grew up in London. Many moons ago. How's the weather?
The weather is absolutely delightful today.
Good.
Having a really, really good spring. It's not always the case, but I could. What am I? If I put the video on, and can I put the video on and show you? That showing you sort of.
That's what I miss. And people, we are still recording, and I will say I just saw a beautiful shot outside.
I didn't know we were still recording.
So and I miss the lush green. Yeah.
Often the weather in England would be nothing to show off about, but today there's a chestnut tree looking very, very spiffing out there.
Very nice. Well, you know what, Patrick? I wish you all the best with
likewise.
The book.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the talk.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I am hoping you do write another one, maybe on Beethoven.
Great. We shall see. Thanks so much for the interview. In the meantime, I really, really enjoyed it. And
of course.
And I'm grateful for your interest.
Okay, so if you enjoyed my chat with Patrick, in the show notes, I've placed the link for you to purchase the book, if you so desire. And also in the show notes, if you feel like buying me a coffee for those late nights that I spend researching, writing these episodes and editing and uploading and all that jazz, that's also much appreciated because I do love caffeine and coffee goes a long way. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. And I'll catch you next time.